You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Will Dowd. He's calling me from Massachusetts. Will, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Will, let's talk about your book is what we're discussing today, Areas of Fog. And do you want to tell me a little bit about it before you read the a little bit from it to get us oriented?
Yeah, I'll give you a little short précis. The book is actually a weather journal that I kept for one calendar year. So I started the journal on January 1st and I ended on the following January 1st. It's structured by month, and so it's made up of these short entries. They're sort of essays. Some of them read a little bit like prose poems. And I was inspired by New England weather. And what I can do is read the first entry, which I wrote on New Year's Day, because it kind of explains why I chose to embark on this odd little weather project.
Okay.
All right, so this is called Overture. All the weathermen of New England go mad eventually. After a few decades spent attempting to predict the unpredictable, they succumb to a kind of meteorological nihilism and wander out of the studio mid-broadcast, muttering to themselves, and can be seen a week later selling wilted roses on the side of the highway. It's not the seasonal anarchy, all those balmy Christmases and washed-out Junes, but rather the perverse changeability of our daily weather, the adolescent moodiness of our sun and sky, that finally unravels the sweater of their sanity. Mark Twain, a Hartford resident for 17 years, once quipped, "In the spring, I have counted 136 different kinds of weather inside of 4 and 20 hours. Yet while they may be doomed to fail, we don't mock our weathermen, even though we see them for what they are, oracles draped in sheep entrails. We don't change the channel. We listen politely to their forecast, and then we talk about it. In New England, the weather is all we talk about, especially when we have nothing to talk about. Lately, I've been suffering from writer's block. It's a serious disease. It struck Twain in the midst of composing The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. After scratching 400 handwritten pages over the course of a single summer, the author suddenly found he could not write another word. For years, Huck and Jim were left stranded on the river, paddling in place. Eventually, Twain found his cure, a refreshing 16-month trip through Europe. I'm hoping to find my cure closer to home. Over the next year, I plan to keep a weather journal, a kind of running retrospective forecast. It will be accurate, for one thing. I can say it rained today with 100% certainty, for example, because I swallowed some of it. But I have another reason for glancing at the near meteorological past. Writers only ever use the atmosphere for atmosphere. They never give the weather its literary due. Of course, weather is necessary to a narrative of human experience, Twain wrote, but it ought to be put where it will not be in the way, where it will not interrupt the flow of the narrative. So here's a place just for the weather, a snow globe without a figurine or a monument, just the weather, and maybe, probably, my reflection in the glass. So that's
really
the opening.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Such beautiful writing. Of course, I have the book and have read it, but beautiful, beautiful writing. And so let's talk a little bit about this. That was the beginning. That was the first entry. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's the first entry. And, you know, when I started, I didn't really know what it was going to look like every week. I kind of had this idea in my head that I would create these little literary snow globes and just kind of every week just describe the weather. But what quickly happened, as soon as the first week in January, my first entry after the kind of introduction, is that I started to talk about the weather, but then inevitably improvise and free associate. And so what ended up happening is that each essay, my head kind of becomes the snow globe, and every week I would shake it up and kind of see what was inside it. And the weather just provided this great conversation starter, or like an icebreaker, kind of in the way we use it in our conversations with strangers. And so that opens the essays, and then they just sort of go on a journey that is completely new and unplanned.
Well, and also almost, you know, I don't know what the exact term is for it, but also that they go into the fantastic, that it's not just riffing on the weather, as in the piece you just read, we're talking about, you know, weathermen going insane, and you know, which is just kind of a wonderful idea and imagery, but it's also completely fantastic, a fiction that you're inventing with each day almost, right?
Yeah, that's true. So there's a lot of historical fact in the book, and I spent quite a long time afterwards creating a work cited that was pretty stringent. But there are definitely times when I take poetic license. I think it's clear to the reader when I'm doing so, and I kind of just let my imagination run. So I really like that combination of fact and fancy in a compressed space. Maybe it's my background as a poet, but that really appeals to me.
Well, and also this structure that you set up for yourself, which seems very convenient. You're doing, I mean, something with literally every day for 365 days.
Well, I wasn't that dedicated. I just did one entry a week. So once a week, I would sit. Yeah. I could have done it the way you've lined it up, and maybe just written them shorter pieces. But I think I might have gotten a little crazy, especially during the long winter months of every day writing about the slush and snow. At least if I was writing on a weekly basis, there would be some kind of change or something new. It didn't get too repetitive or Groundhog's Day-ish.
Well, it's a nice way of also having a structure that's free enough that you can do what you want, but structured enough so that in a year you have a significant piece of writing.
Absolutely. And when I started it, I had no idea. I would have thought you were crazy if you told me that this was going to end as a book. I mean, I'm like physically holding it right now, and I still can't believe it's a book. And because when I started it, it was just an exercise to kind of try to break out of a rut. And I did it kind of dutifully for a year, and then I didn't look at it for another year, and then I thought, hey, maybe I wonder if those hang together, if I put them all together, and did so and sent it out, and somehow somebody picked it up and liked it, and now I'm getting some good responses, but it was not calculated. But you're right, it's a great way to accumulate material is by doing something, keeping your head down and just doing one a week or one a day or whatever it is. And then if you don't look up for a long time, when you finally do, you'll find a nice stack.
Right. And so let's hear another piece from it, if you don't mind. I'd love to hear, I know you're going to read perhaps two more times, but what is the next piece that you're thinking of reading?
Yeah, I'll read this one. I haven't read this one out loud before. This is called Rara Avis, which means rare bird, and it's from the month of May. And this is how it goes. Today is one of those rainy spring days. Dripping trees, muddy lawns, earthworms wriggling on wet pavement. That makes me think of the spare, pensive piano music of Erik Satie, a Parisian composer, 148 years old this week, who never left his apartment without a bowler hat and one of his hundreds of umbrellas, which he would carry whenever it rained, rolled up beneath his yellow corduroy coat, lest it get wet. I've been watching and listening to the birds outside my window. They're perched like notes on the musical staves of the telephone wires. I am not, nor have I ever been, a birder. I prefer spotting eccentrics in the foliage of history. But I've always wondered about birdsong and what it means. And why, when I'm writing at an outdoor cafe and I've had too much espresso, I sometimes suspect the sparrows fluttering beneath the wrought iron tables are talking about me. The other night when I couldn't sleep, I sat on my front steps, mild breeze, half moon sailing, and listened to the dawn chorus. It's an unnerving anthem. So many keyed up soloists singing as if the world were ending. A black kitten appeared from nowhere, mewled, then sprinted away from my outstretched hand. I watched it disappear between two bushes. I listened harder, knowing that one of the voices in the chorus would soon be silenced by a set of tiny teeth. I know it's not wise to ask too much of life, but I would feel cheated if I died before hearing the liquid song of a living nightingale, whose music has been receiving unanimous raves since the invention of the written word. Well, almost unanimous. Satie insisted that the bird was overrated. Not only is its voice not properly placed, he wrote, but it knows nothing of keys or pitches or modes or measures. To be fair to the nightingale, neither do I. Of course, the language of the birds is not a complete mystery. When we listen to birdsong in North America, we're mostly hearing males trying to outsing each other in competition for a mate. It certainly worked for Satie. One night, while he was playing piano at the Auberge de Clue, a cheap nightclub in Montmartre, his music attracted the attention of Suzanne Valadon, a local painter who kept a pet goat in her studio so she could feed it her unsatisfactory drawings. They embarked on an impassioned 6-month affair that ended when Satie, consumed by jealousy, pushed Valadon out of her 3-story window. Fortunately, Suzanne Valadon was a true eccentric, which meant that before her life as a painter and an artist's model, she had been a teenage circus acrobat specializing in the trapeze, so she knew just how to land on the paving stones of Rue Courteau and spring to her feet, unscathed, unruffled, and newly single.
Oh my God, that's very exciting. I mean, great piece of writing, but also a great and dramatic ending. Yeah, really, really wonderful, Will. So to talk about that piece of writing, it's kind of interesting the way it begins, saying that you're not a bird watcher or a bird person, and then you reveal this wealth of information, which seems like it's all well researched and true. Although I don't know if that's true about throwing that woman out the window or any of that, but suddenly you reveal all this. It sounds like, as you were talking about earlier, this information that you've learned about birds, as well as Satie, that's all from research.
Yeah, that's all stuff that just was stuck in my brain. So that's true, that story about Satie and his brief fling with Suzanne Valadon, who is a little hero of mine for her ability to survive that crazed affair. So I think, you know, one of the reasons I really like that essay. I haven't read it before because I think it's hard to take all in. It jumps all over the place. But that's part of what the joy I derived from the project, what I would start and then just kind of create this web of associations and try to make things tie together. It was sort of like being on a tightrope. I never quite knew if it was going to work or if I would just crash and burn. But sometimes it would come together and it would feel a bit faded. And I really enjoy kind of creating connections and associations. And I certainly have a sticky brain for these kind of historical anecdotes and biography. A lot of these characters in the book, these historical figures, are just these important people to me that I read about growing up, and I feel as if I know.
It's fascinating because in that piece, I mean, you were talking about jumping around, but also the last, leap. Out of the picture, out of Satie's life, also seems to echo some of how you're jumping around. I mean, it comes off very smoothly in how it's being done. But there's what I'm saying is it seems like there's almost a physicality to the way you're jumping down. Even with the weatherman, the way we're moving around, there seems to be a lot of, kind of physical movement that echoes perhaps this way of moving between content too.
I think it's funny you say that. I think you're right. I think if I could dance, I wouldn't write. I think my writing makes up for my bad inability to dance. When I write, I tend to sort of turn on my heels. That's how it feels when I change directions, it definitely feels physical to me. I think it's funny you're able to pick up on that, because that's definitely how it feels when I'm writing. It's this kind of swift movements, but somehow connecting them in the way you would a dance. And actually, you know, it also relates to something else, which is that I'm writing in the essay form. The essay form is such a broad form. We all know argumentative essays. I feel like we're just living in those kind of times. But there's essays that can be lyrical, and the goal of a lyrical essay is often very different. And I always think of it as the goal is to take flight. And so I think maybe that was in the back of my head when I was musing about birds and in this final leap, because you're kind of looking for an ending that sort of transcends what came before, somehow just lifts off. So, yeah.
That's so interesting. Yeah, that's really clear. And I'm glad you made that distinction between a kind of lyrical essay or the, which is true, mostly all I hear of or have heard of is the argumentative essay, which I think by that you mean, you know, you have an argument at the beginning of the essay and you prove it throughout the essay, right? You have a, you know,
right.
Assumption.
You have a thesis, yeah. Yeah.
But the way you know, you're talking about it is a much more lyrical essay allows you, well, it's closer to poetry, which is, of course, your world, right? It's a more poetic form, it seems.
That's right. I'm not trying to, none of these weather essays are meant to persuade anyone of anything. They're meant to be an experience.
Let's read one more, if you don't mind.
Sure.
From this book.
Yeah, I'm gonna choose another one that involves a painter, because I know you interview a lot of artists and curators, and so perhaps this will be of interest to them. This is from the summer. This was written in July, and it's called The Painter of Sunflowers. Between the crushing heat of the July sun and the occasional flash flood, it's been a difficult week for people and flowers. We're all feeling a bit withered. Only my neighbor's sunflowers, which bloomed over the weekend, seemed to be thriving. When I spotted these sunflowers, I thought of Vincent van Gogh, who had already been on my mind. He worshipped sunflowers and painted them compulsively, from life in the summer, from memory in the winter. A portrait by Paul Gauguin, his friend and rival, shows him in the act. It's called The Painter of Sunflowers. Van Gogh hated it. He said, "It's certainly me, but it's me gone mad." I like the painting. I like its forced perspective, how it looks as if Van Gogh is painting the sunflower itself into existence. When it comes to Van Gogh and his short life, reality and metaphor are swirled together. This was, after all, a man who nibbled his oil paints like an aspiring synesthete. It began early, when his mother delivered a stillborn son named Vincent van Gogh. Our Van Gogh, the replacement child, was born a year later to the day. He was both Vincent and a metaphor for the lost Vincent. Later, as a painter of blazing pastures in the south of France, he suffered bouts of mania and delirium. Did he stare too long into the sun of his creative passion, or was it just severe sunstroke? I think his suicide was a metaphor too, or at least it was meant to be. Just a few weeks before Van Gogh shot himself in a wheat field, he'd borrowed a revolver to scare off crows, his brother Theo had announced he was moving to Holland. Theo was the wooden frame to Vincent's stretched canvas. Without Theo, Vincent's financial and emotional survival was at risk. In the past, whenever someone tried to leave, Van Gogh resorted to self-mutilation. When Gauguin moved out of the yellow house, he sliced off his left ear with a razor. When a girl he loved skipped town, he held his hand over a candle flame, vowing to keep it there until she returned. When Van Gogh shot himself in the chest, he missed his heart. It was supposed to be a symbolic act, a metaphor. "This is what you are doing to me, Theo." And it only became literal as the result of an inept country doctor. At least that's how I read it. And this brings me to the reason why Van Gogh has been on my mind. An Italian artist named Demont Streb has unveiled a living replica of Van Gogh's left ear, the one he severed, which she recreated using DNA from an envelope Van Gogh sealed in 1883. The ear was grown in Boston with the help of scientists from MIT and Harvard. It's currently on display in a German museum. Until now, if you hope to divine the true source of Van Gogh's madness and solve the mystery of his suicide, you had to study the letters and stare at the paintings. How much easier it will be to pluck a red hair from a thick brushstroke and grow another Van Gogh and watch to see how this one kills himself. Van Gogh was buried in a hilltop cemetery. His coffin was heaped with sunflowers. It was late July. According to one mourner, the sun was unbearable.
Very beautiful. Thank you, Will.
Sure, thanks.
Yeah, of course, there's all kinds of wonderful things about that piece. I have to ask about that one artist. Is that true, regrowing his ear? Because that's certainly something that's within the realm of possibility.
That it is true. I would, even my most surrealistic poetic imagination wouldn't have been able to conjure that up. I can't believe it's a scientific possibility now. It looks extremely odd. I haven't seen it in person, but I've seen it, the images online, and it's just this you know, ear tissue in a kind of glass case, floating in some kind of fluid, and it's totally off-putting to me and strange and Black Mirror-ish, and it just was kind of haunting me. And I think when I sat down to write and looked out my window and saw was thinking about the heat and saw those sunflowers, those two things just came together pretty powerfully.
Yeah, very beautiful. I'm so glad you read that particular piece. In the context of all your work, I mean, this is your first book, right? You've written essays and published previously in magazines and other publications. How does this book feel to you in the context of all your other works? Does it seem like it's a cumulative process that where you are now, or is this a different direction? I'm just kind of asking about this particular book, Areas of Fog, in the context of all the work you've previously done.
Yeah, what I loved about this project was the freedom. Like we talked about earlier, it gave me this structure, but then within it, I could go a little bit wild. And I have a lot of, you know, even though I studied some specific subjects, including poetry, probably for the lengthiest time, I have a lot of interest in art history and science and literary history. And so within this kind of box, I was able to pour in a lot of the contents from my brain. So this book is sort of like, if you read it, it's kind of like you're taking this zip line tour through my obsessions and preoccupations. And so I feel really excited about it because I just feel like I may never again hit upon a conceit that gives the reader just such access to what is rattling around in my brain. And so in that sense, it's kind of a wild, strange book, but I think it's going to hold meaning for me even long into the future.
Well, it's, I hope you will find that a conceit. Could use this one again and again, because it's a really wonderful, wonderful book. And I want to congratulate you on that. Before we go, I want to ask you, what you're reading now, the question I ask everybody at the end.
Well, I just finished listening to an audiobook by Scott McClanahan. He both wrote it and narrated it. It's called The Sarah Book, and it's a really emotionally haunting book, and I actually started it. I was in the hospital with meningitis in the late summer, and in the nights, hospitals, I find extremely creepy places at night. I would listen to it on my iPod, and it was just a very affecting book and has kind of lingered with me. And so I finished that recently, and then I've moved on to this really interesting book by Fleur Yeagy called Those Possible Lives, and it's kind of these experimental biographical pieces. And actually the translator, because it was written in Italian, the translator, Mina Zolman Proctor, was on a panel with me at the Boston Book Festival this weekend, just randomly by chance. So that felt like one of, you know, Carl Jung's synchronicities or something. So that's what's going on in my reading life right now.
Will, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing from you and about your book.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.